Hello and welcome to another episode of Another Brick in the Wall. I'm very excited to be back this year. We've just started a new season, and as opposed to talking about materials in specific, this time we're going to really focus on buildings in remote locations and buildings that are quite unique and special. And I'm really, really happy to have with me Jennifer Benningfield from Open Studios Architects in London. And the project we're going to talk about is a project I think is very dear to Jennifer. It's a house that she's designed and seen built for herself, sitting in the middle of the Karoo. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Pedro.
Pleasure. Nice to meet you. Really nice having you on the podcast, and really happy that you sort of accepted the invitation so fast. The house, for those that can't see it, is a series of beautiful monolithic white, I'm not going to call them cubes because not all of them are cubes, but like white stacked boxes that sit in this amazing landscape. It's something that I've understood you took some time to plan. It's been in your sort of DNA to do this house for quite a long time.
Yeah, so I've been traveling to that particular place since 2000. And I bought the land in 2008. So I'd been traveling regularly to Prince Albert for about 8 years before I actually bought the land. And then all sorts of things intervened, you know, working for other people, doing other people's buildings. And also I had a child in 2010. It did take a long time to start construction. Construction was only started in 2013. So I had 5 years to think about the project, visit the site, and decide what I wanted to do.
Wartburg House, as it's called, for those that haven't been there and haven't got the opportunity to see it, there are some documentaries online. You can find them on Jennifer's website. There's links to that, and you can also find loads of information, photographs about the building. But in order to get there and to get to Prince Albert, can you kind of describe how long it takes and what's that process like?
From London?
From London, for example, yeah.
I'm South African originally, so I still have family in Johannesburg, and I go and visit them on the way. So I have a slightly sort of convoluted trip. If I was going to go straight to Prince Albert, I'd either fly to Cape Town from London and then drive for about 4.5 hours into the Karoo. But what I normally do because of my family situation is I go to Johannesburg, I spend a little bit of time there, and then either I drive down, it's about 10 and a half, 11 hours from Johannesburg, or I fly to a little town called George and then drive for about 2.5 hours. So best case scenario is 24 hours.
And you'd consider it a remote location, despite Albert being a beautiful village?
Well, it is remote because there isn't an airport anywhere nearby. And no matter what, you have to, pretty much have to drive to get there. And there aren't any close large towns. It's a very small town.
The house kind of nests into the landscape beautifully. It was designed with that in mind, I understand.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things, even before I bought the site, I looked at lots of different places in the town. And what's interesting about Prince Albert is it's there because of the water from the mountain. It's there because of the spring. So the mountains are extremely tall, and they get snow in the winter, and then the snow feeds this mountain spring. The water feeds the town. The town is there. The town is made possible because of the water. But because the main road runs north-south, the properties all run east-west. And so very few of the pieces of land actually look at the Swartberg, which is kind of crazy given that it's the reason for the town's existence. And so it took me a really long time to find a piece of land that had a view of the mountain that is the reason for the town's existence. It was very much part of the reason I bought the site at all, and also the sort of anchor to the house. The language of the house is very much about how does this building read, you know, a domestic structure. How does it read against the absolute magnificence of nature and the mountains? And that's, I have an aversion to buildings that have flat horizontal. lines against natural forms. And so I wanted something that not only was softer against the mountain, but also moved three-dimensionally as you moved around it. So it wasn't a static modernist box.
Yeah, I haven't had the privilege of seeing it, but from the video footage I've seen and from the photographs I've seen, it's a house that captures light in a very particular way, both internally and out and externally, the way it's been finished. And I think, if you don't mind, I'd like to focus on that for a bit. I understand that the technology used and the way the house was built, the materials, is kind of almost like a, I wouldn't call it vernacular because it's not the vernacular of South Africa or of that part of South Africa, but it does reinterpret some of the Cape Colonial and the Cape Colonial Revival movements, but done in a completely new and modernistic way.
Yeah, so the construction is actually extremely simple. It's load-bearing brick. But what doesn't normally happen in South Africa is that buildings aren't normally insulated. So it does incorporate insulation in the wall structure. It is actually, I mean, the old buildings in the Karoo are mud walls, but more contemporary buildings are pretty much all built in brick and rendered, generally cavity brick, uninsulated, or solid brickwork. So it takes the principle of what people are doing routinely and then pushes it a little bit further by making a thermal envelope that's more efficient.
And when you were designing it, how important was it to sort of build in a level of tolerance for how the detailing and the finishing of the house was going to be done? I've worked in many remote locations myself, and I believe in this sort of idea that architecture, although we're taught in the West and in Western schools of architecture to draw with a very fine pen, I think architecture needs to be designed almost with a fat pen, because sometimes the skill of the people building it doesn't go past the fat pen. So tell us a bit about that, because the texture of the building is beautiful.
Yes, the texture of the building, it does a number of things, actually. It's a very traditional way of finishing buildings in the Karoo. So this very beautiful old church in town, but also a lot of the other buildings in town are finished with the same rough cast plaster with lime wash, which is exactly the same as my house. The difference usually is that in older buildings, you see they put a very smooth render around window and door openings. So they kind of frame it up. I didn't want that at all. I wanted something more monolithic. The reason that I like that rough cast plaster, well, there's several reasons. One is that I knew they could do it, and I knew they could do it well. The second thing is I wanted a building that was kind of a hybrid building, I suppose. A building that was both ancient and modern at the same time. And I liked the fact that it connected to the history of building in the Karoo and the history of building in the town in terms of the finish. It was important to me that it was lime washed and not painted, because the lime wash softens over time, and it also has a kind of thickness to it. So the more layers you put on, the softer the texture becomes. So it kind of tracks time in the way you maintain it. And you see that in the church, which has a very, very beautiful texture that you can see only comes through time. So I'm sort of hoping that the house develops that too. But there are a lot of flat roof buildings in the Karoo as well. They're called the brakduk buildings, and they were done in very cubic forms, flat roofs, mud roofs. So I'm sort of trying to connect to that more ancient way of building in the Karoo as well, something that's not just about the Victorian buildings, but some a sort of older system of construction that my building refers to.
Yeah. And then I've heard you talk about the building, and you said that it's a building that, apart from the building itself, there is no technology in it. Yeah. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Well, this is, I mean, as part of kind of what you were saying about the idea of tolerance and forgiveness in buildings. You know, I work in London, and we work to very, very tech-heavy buildings, extremely tech-heavy buildings. And the issue with that is maintenance and fixing it and who does it, alongside sort of maybe more ethical considerations about the amount of M&E you have to put into a building in order to get it to operate you know, to a carbon effective level. You know, it's a lot of metal. And I felt sort of multiple reasons for doing this. One is I prefer buildings that operate in a more natural way and that ask their occupants to inhabit them in a way that is aware of the external environment and where the thinking is not done for you. Like a lot of the buildings that we occupy in first world environments, the building kind of does the thinking for us and we don't have to take responsibility for our actions because everything is just done for us. And also they have to be fixed, you know, because things break. And so I wanted a building that was almost bomb-proof in terms of that it didn't really break, because how on earth was that going to work, you know, given how remote the town is. But also a kind of linking to this idea that if we have to operate the building in order to make our internal temperatures comfortable, that somehow we have to be more in tune with our environment. We have to pay more attention to our environment and we have to be more present in the place that we're in, because it's a kind of a dialogue with nature and with the rhythms of the day. And it's about a different way of living that I think is very grounding.
Yeah. The Karoo essentially has an environment and a climate that can vary quite dramatically. We can get temperatures up in the high 30s, probably even low 40s, all the way down to negative and -4, -6 maybe. And the house, from what I've seen, copes with this in many ways, like the central living space, which I've heard you again describe it almost like an idea of a cathedral, something that inspired you ever since the small girl when you visited architecture. And it's got this central fireplace, which is very sculptoric in it, but also plays an important role in heating up the house, I presume. And then in the summer, you've got these multiple little vents that you can open. Are they all manually operated?
Yes, they are. They're all manually operated from the roof. There's a solar geyser in the house that heats the water. There isn't any cooling apart from the building itself. And you know, obviously there's a fridge and there's that sort of thing, but there isn't any equipment apart from the fireplace. There isn't any equipment for heating. And the vents, the thing also about the house is that because it operates sort of three dimensionally, people always look, they come into the house and they look at the vents and they say, how on earth do you open them? But you just open them by going up the staircase and walking around on the roof, and which is an occupiable space, and then just opening them.
And then not only do you do that, but you look and sort of enjoy the magnificent views you have all around it. So it's almost like an experience. You live through the building as you operate and activate different parts of it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Like I said, you were the client. And how long did it take you to design this building? And how was that process sort of dealing with yourself, you know, managing a budget, managing a site that was, I don't know, 24 hours away, as we've just discussed? How was that whole experience?
It's so funny, actually, because people always say to me, it must have been so difficult. It must have been so challenging. But actually, it was the easiest project I ever did. And the reason for that is, I think we spend a lot of time as architects trying to convince people that we've really listened to them, because I do think it's really important for architects to listen to people. And we, you know, spending a lot of time in dialogue with clients, trying to find out what they want, and then responding to that, and then showing them something and saying, you know, we do this, we've really listened to you, and this is what we think would really work for you. But I didn't have any of that. I could just decide. And also there's some things in the house that I think I would have struggled to get people to agree to, clients to agree to. Maybe very enlightened clients would have agreed to them. But for example, all the plaster on the interior is rough. It's the same as the exterior. And the brick floors are just brick pavers laid on edge. And I think, you know, that's quite a hard thing to convince clients to sign up to, because it's not normal. They wouldn't have seen it somewhere. So the design process was actually very, very easy in terms of knowing what I wanted. I made a list for myself at the beginning. And I, at the top, I think I wrote fun is important. You know, like you can have different things in your brief, but I took a long time to design it, not in terms of time that I spent on the building necessarily, but I would say more thinking time and time when I put it aside. So I had a full design before my daughter was born in 2010, but I just didn't feel it was right, actually. So I'd done it, I drew it, I had the whole set of working drawings, I had everything done, but I just didn't feel it was quite right. And so I just put it to one side and, you know, had the baby. Time passed as it does. And then I was just really thinking about it. And I thought, you know, now I know what to do. Just let it settle. And then I knew what to do and I did it. And it was right. And then I knew it was right, actually. And I just had this feeling like that was it. That was the right building. And that's when I built it.
Okay. And how did you set about then finding the right people to build this building? Because as you say, you took a lot of the ways that people know how to build things there, but you still had some very special items. You know, the carpentry is very precise and outstanding. The render itself, although it seems simple, still requires a certain amount of skill. I've tried to do rough cast render and it's not always that simple. It looks simple, but it's not. So how did you put all of that together? Because you were living in London back then.
Yeah, I was living in London. I'd been to Prince Albert very regularly, at least once a year for by the time I started construction, like 13 years. It's a small town and I'd visited a lot of buildings and I'd met with there are a few contractors in town. So I'd met with them and I'd seen their work and I knew who I wanted to work with. There was really only one person that I wanted to work with. And so his name is Hendrik de Villiers. He's really, really, really wonderful. And one of the reasons he's wonderful is he really looks at drawings. He really understood what I was asking him to build. So I basically waited until he was free because he doesn't do a lot of projects. He only does one or two at a time. So I waited till he was free. Back to your earlier question, though, about this idea of tolerance in construction, I completely agree. Like even in first world environments, you have to allow tolerance. The way we deal with that often in our buildings is, and this is the way the Swartberg house is built, is that the kind of the architectural frame has a degree of flex in it. And then within that, we put very refined pieces and they kind of play off against each other. So you get a kind of language of materials through the way it's thought about. And there was a very good joiner that I knew in Johannesburg, and he did every single thing that's timber in that building, everything. Or the shutters, the internal joinery, the cupboards, every single thing. And he made it in Joburg, and then he came down, he brought his team, and they basically moved into the shell of the house. And they
lived there for a while.
Yeah, they were there for a while. I think they didn't want to leave. They loved it. And they put it in. But we also had done quite a lot of coordination work with the main contractor on just how to deal with the interface between something that was very refined and something that was much rougher. And so we put basically little steel subframe angles into all the openings. And we basically had like a double system of little steel subframes that got set into the door openings that were made by the joiner.
So they were pre-made, so you could have them set and get all the openings perfectly done. Yeah,
exactly. So the joiner made two pieces that fitted together, the timber and the steel. And then he sent the steel down to the main contractor. The main contractor fitted those steel pieces into the openings to make sure that they were absolutely right. Everything was done to brick dimensions as well to try to minimize mess ups. And then when the timber came, it just fitted into the steel. So actually it worked very, very smoothly and very easily. But the rough cast plus, you're totally right, was very, very difficult to get right. And because everybody has a different hand, everybody has a different gesture. And so in the end, the contractor had two guys and they did the whole building because he had two people and they did everything, because as soon as he put somebody, it took a bit longer, but you know, as soon as he put other people on, you could see the different gestures. So we just limited it.
And throughout this whole process, how long did it take to build?
About 18 months.
Okay. And you were going down almost every 6 weeks to see progress and to see how things were going.
Yeah.
I can't remember. So this is 2014. Presumably WhatsApp was around and photos were flying backwards and forwards between the Karoo and London, or every time you turned up, it was new and new, totally unexpected problem to resolve.
No. I had a lovely structural engineer who was the engineer for the project called Ian Canning. And he was the sort of person on the ground, and he would send me questions and photos.
Yeah. Compared to some of the work you do in London, and I've seen the Westminster Fire Brigade.
The fire station, yeah.
Fire station, exactly. Which is different scale, some similar principles in terms of the attention to detail and some of the quality of the architecture. But how would you describe building and working in a complete, you know, Western environment, first world environment, such as London, and doing a project in the Karoo, where although you can get some, you know, first world skills sometimes, you also have to deal with some people which have lower skills, different skills, but sometimes more passion for things than we find in our sort of more industrialized world. How do you compare the two worlds in a way?
Yeah, it's really interesting, actually, because my experience of building that particular house in Prince Albert was that everybody was very invested in the project and very invested in doing their job really well. You know, so there was a lot of care that went into it, and you can see that, I think, in the house. And I didn't ever feel that it was a struggle. You know, it wasn't a struggle. It felt very much like a team effort. And even though, you know, people have very different skill levels, but you have to work with the skill level that they have and, you know, really design with that in mind. And I actually think if you do that and if you give respect to the people who are building things, you get a better building. But, you know, you're very conscious of that if you're building in a remote location, because it seems like an insurmountable problem. Actually, it's not so different if you're working in first world environments, because you still have to get the right people, right? And you still have to get people who care about it. For Westminster Fire Station, we have very unusual brickwork in that building. We had a contractor originally who I think sort of underestimated how different it was from normal construction, and actually just didn't care. They just wanted to throw it up as quickly as possible. And things only really started to go right with that project when we had an amazing foreman who came to site, and he really cared. He really wanted to make something beautiful. So I think that in a way, the principles are not so different. It's like building is about people. It's for people, but it's also by people. And I think you have to understand the dynamic of who's building it, why are they building it, and also bring people along on the journey with you when you build anything, because if you don't, you're not going to get anything of any quality, whether you're building in London or whether you're building in South Africa.
Yeah. No, it's true. I think I completely agree with what you're saying. What I have found, and I now base most of my work in Portugal, it's where I've moved to, and there are some principles about the work we do here, which are different from the UK in many ways. And I've worked in the UK as well for a period of time. But there seems to be, and I might be totally unfair what I'm going to say next, but when I worked in Southern Africa and when I work in Portugal and when I work or talk to people that work in locations where there's still a level of craftsmanship, or when you can work in the UK with real craftsmen, you find people that really care about that work, and that brings out the qualities of the architecture a lot more than when you're working on, you know, very precise glass and steel buildings, which as a young architect, a lot of people go through those offices and end up designing it. And I think some of that regionalism and some of that contextualism is lost as certain skills become more professional. And it's not a bad thing they become professional, but at the same time, there is stuff that is lost. And I think finding that balance is important. That's one of the things I loved in your building, really. It's the balance between the two worlds.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the fire station, I mean, I am very interested in buildings that ground people in place. So the philosophy behind the fire station and the house in the Karoo is actually kind of the same. You know, it's how do we make something that has texture? The fire station has actually quite a lot of, if texture is not a machine-made building at all. And I do think that the buildings that are made that are sort of in a more mechanical way, or they're more modular, or they're the glass buildings with all the gaskets and the structure and everything's exposed. I do think that people know how to do those very easily. But with the fire station, what we ended up finding was that the people who did the brickwork in the end were all in their late 50s, early 60s, which is interesting, right? Because I think there was one young guy. There was one young guy who was sort of late 20s, but he was really the exception. And it's in, because, you know, obviously there are amazing craftspeople in the UK, just absolutely astonishing. And you can get anything done, you know, anything done, any material, anything beautifully done. But not universally across like all sectors of the market. Like if budget is no problem, then of course there are the people who will do things absolutely exquisitely. But if you're dealing with more challenging budgets, then then times you don't have those kinds of choices. So every building is different. I do think though that this idea of kind of tactility and making things by hand is as valid in first world environments as it is in more remote locations.
Definitely. I think that is a lesson a lot of people have learned, but I find that people that have a mixed background and have worked in different types of environments do tend to realize that. And it then reflects in their architecture as well. I just wanted to ask you one final question. And the house is now 10 years old. How has it aged? And is there anything that you'd go back and do differently?
I'm really fortunate in that I actually wouldn't change anything. And I think I wouldn't change anything mainly because I had a lot of time to think about the building before I built it. It really wasn't a tearing rush and there was no deadline at all, apart from, you know, wanting to be there. So there isn't actually anything I would change, which seems like a weird thing to say, but it's a very complex building. It allows people to live in it in lots of different ways, and it allows for a big mix of people to inhabit it at the same time and make different choices about being there. And that's been a really wonderful success of the building. In terms of aging, the thing that has totally transformed the building has been the landscape. When I built the house, there was really nothing around it. That part of the site was almost completely empty. And so we put in these like little twigs that were very, very small. And so you see the house and it's completely stark and there's these tiny little like bits of timber. And the landscape was always supposed to be very much part of the building. And now it is. And so that is a really wonderful thing to see. I couldn't go during COVID. I went back after COVID. And all of a sudden, the trees were like proper trees. And it was fantastic. As far as the weathering of the house goes, so because the house is lime washed, it actually weathers in a very gentle way. The challenge in the Karoo is sun, and especially sun on timber. So we do re-oil the shutters every year and the wooden windows every year. Then I think we have re-lime washed once only. The building just kind of gets progressively kind of less white, and then you lime wash it and it becomes sort of, you know, whiter again. Yeah, but actually it's a very, because it's built out of solid materials and you know, natural finishes, it actually weathers incredibly well. And water wise, you know, it hardly rains. So you don't have the same problem with damp or anything else. So actually it's a very robust building. It's a tough building, and yeah, come and visit.
I'd love to. It's really, it was one of those buildings that it was shown to me. I wasn't expecting it at all. And I was fascinated by it because it encompasses so many things that I've thought about and love in architecture generally. And it really inspired me. And I hope it inspires a lot more people. You know, it's published on many websites, magazines. There's a documentary, as we've discussed. But I just wanted to share it with as many people as I can, especially in a country like Portugal, which is the base of the majority of people that hear us. Then some people hear us from overseas. But it gives a chance to architects and the general public to discover a building that's quite unique in the way it's been designed, but also the way it interacts with its environment, with its location. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Pedro.
I hope people ask more and more questions about the building. I hope you have many more opportunities to visit and enjoy it. Thank you, Jennifer, for being on the show.
Pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. And for those listening back home, thanks again for tuning in. And we hope to catch you again soon.